This is Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Welcome to the unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City. Brian Diaz here with you. Yes, here on the NOLA Drinks Show, friends, we are here to support your dreams. If you're here playing your part, doing what you're supposed to do, we support your dreams here on the NOLA Drinks Show. Yeah, that's what we do, at least as much as we can. Probably not much, but we try and we play our part and we do that. So there you go. Hey, got a good show coming up for you today, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. Friends, one of the things that you know that I always like to do here on the show whenever it's necessary, sadly, whenever it's necessary, and it is again, is talking about helping our neighbors. We've been talking about helping our neighbors to the west in Texas, victims of Hurricane Harvey, and places you can go to donate. A little bit of an emphasis on how the hospitality industry and that sort of thing connects to that, how they're helping out, but other things as well. If you go to our Facebook page, noladrinks.com, and scroll down a little bit, 5-6 posts in, you'll see 2-3 posts that we have done there that have very worthy organizations, maybe beyond the obvious. I'm not telling you how much to give, how to give, just help if you can kind of thing. But if you're looking for targeted ways to give, for example, or good solid organizations, check that out. I'm still gathering information on local efforts and these sorts of things where you can help out as it relates to our neighbors to the east with Hurricane Irma in Florida and also in the Caribbean, which I don't want to give short shrift to as well. These people are going to need our help as well. We know what that's all about here, being helped and giving help here in New Orleans. So if you can kind of bear with me until next week, I'm going to be gathering up some good resources that come recommended from people and groups that I trust, and I'll share those with you. Check out again our Facebook page on NOLA Drinks, facebook.com/NOLA Drinks, and you'll find it there. And I think I said NOLADrinks.com. Of course, that's our website. You can get there that way to our Facebook page. That's where we're putting the stuff. So yes, please help and give where you can to situations that need urgency and help and support. So wanted to mention that. Also wanted to mention, well, hey, you know, it's the weather's beautiful. I need to say that because, you know, I like to gripe about the weather when it's really hot here, which I do sometimes, and humid. Now, here's the irony. If you're listening to the show last week, and I tried not to whine about it too much, but of course, came down with a cold. Who thought that you could get a cold in September? I did. And still getting over. You can probably hear it in my voice a little bit. So the timing of this was impeccable in that I have not been able to enjoy much of the good weather because I was not feeling too good for several days. I'm on the rebound now. I know you're worried about me. I know everybody out there is really worried about me. Okay, so thank you for worrying about me. I'm hoping that tomorrow afternoon I can actually take half a day off with my lovely wife, Sylvia. And while the weather has not gone back to being super hot, catch a little bit of the tail end of this really nice weather and enjoy some of the scene around town. Yeah, I'm sure you're really concerned about that. So I'm going to move on from that anyway, but there's a little bit of an update on me. Hey, thanks for listening there. Wanted to talk a little bit about, well, let's talk about what we have going on the show today. First off, we're going to interview Jim Clark. Jim is a friend of mine. He's the U.S. marketing manager for Wines of South Africa, otherwise known as WOSA. And proud to announce here on the NOLA Drinks Show that we are going to be the official broadcast partner of South Africa Wine Week here in New Orleans, taking place October 30th to November 5th. And the details are kind of shaping up now. But a lot of what's going to be going on is, easy breezy type stuff, right? Restaurants featuring South African wines by the glass for the week, tastings at local wine shops where you can come and explore some of these wines and these sorts of things, some good storytelling information. So again, check out our social media and website because we're going to be sharing a lot of stuff leading up to that, including some interviews leading up to the event and during the event, talking about South African wine. It's interesting story. It's a really fascinating thing, and there's really lots to talk about there. It's a favorite subject of mine from a historical perspective, a winemaking perspective, a cultural perspective, economic. The story is really fascinating because of the effects that basically apartheid had on that society, all kinds of, you know, more important negative effects than wine. The winemaking has been going on there for centuries, but because of apartheid, it was largely closed off to the world because of the embargo. So there weren't a lot of exchanges of ideas with wine regions from other countries and these things. It was a sort of an insular situation. And we'll talk more. We touch on not out with Jim's interview this time, but we will talk about the story of South African wines more and more as we move forward over the next month and a half or so leading up to South Africa Wine Week. But we do talk with Jim a little bit about just kind of some general ideas about wines from that region, a little bit about the history, a little of these concepts. I'm really big on the wines because oftentimes they present a great value. Very often you're talking about not needing to spend any more than maybe $15 to $30, $35, where you get an excellent bottle of wine. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about beer with two good friends of mine, Sal Mortilaro, who is a certified beer judge here in Louisiana, one of the highest ranked judges in the area, really in the country. And he's going to be on the show with us. And then another friend of ours, Matt Horney, who is the brewmaster at Old Rail Brewing Company, which is a microbrew brew pub in Old Mandeville across the lake here from the city. And two super knowledgeable guys about beer. We were kind of meant to talk a little bit about seasonal beers. We're going to talk about fall beers, and we do touch on that. But the conversation with these guys is always so fascinating because they're both so knowledgeable. If you're into beer, and who's not into beer? If you're not into beer, what's wrong with you? Okay, I'm going to say that. But if you're into beer, you're going to want to hear this because we talk about all kinds of stuff. We talk about hops, the different forms in which it comes. We talk about how beer, sometimes people, I think, maybe consider beer to be a static product. Maybe sometimes you think spirits can kind of be a static product, meaning that they sort of taste the same all the time and they're sort of auto-programmed to be how they are. And I think with wine, we might be a little bit more in tune with the idea that it's an agricultural product, the concept of vintage, how it varies from year to year, and these sorts of things. Well, you know, the same holds true, really, in a lot of ways, especially for smaller producers, of beer and spirits. So, we're dealing with agricultural products, hops being a really big, good example. So we talk a lot about that. We talk about water. So different ways that water drives the style of things, styles of beer, and what's in and what's not in the water being really important, how you manage water. And you go, yeah, beer is 98% water. That makes sense, but it's more technical than that. So we talk a lot about that. Really fascinating stuff about beer. So stay tuned for that. Friends, I want to mention a couple things around town. Be sure next week, if you caught the show last week, really great event coming up at the New Orleans Museum of Art outside on their grounds in City Park. Going to be a lot of fun. Love in the Garden taking place Friday, September 22nd from 7 to just before midnight. There's different levels of tickets. There's a patron party at 7, the main garden party at 8, late night party at 9, sort of different costs for different tickets and membership for the museum, which I highly recommend you check out. Becoming a patron of the museum plays in, but there's going to be a cocktail competition, so lots of great bartenders that are going to be out there. Several friends of mine, Paul Gusting's there from Two Jags, Hattie Kateri from Sazerac Bar, my good pal Conrad Cantor from Cane and Table is going to be out there, several other folks that I know and respect, lots of great bartenders, lots of great food, lots of great music, going to be really fun. Go check out noma.org for that. Again, Love in the Garden next Friday, a week from tomorrow if you're listening to the radio broadcast, Friday, September 22nd at 7 o'clock, going to be very cool. Also, lots of, want to mention too, the Jazz in the Vines concert series up there at Pontchartrain Vineyards on the North Shore in Bush, Louisiana. Yep, all the way up there in Bush. It's only Bush is only an hour. I mean, like dead even on an hour to go from downtown New Orleans to get up to the winery. You're out in the country. It's an outdoor concert series. Fall season kicks off with a Charmaine Neville and a special fireworks display. You might be going, fireworks? Why is that happening? Well, basically, that same show that was supposed to feature the fireworks and Charmaine Neville at the end of June in the spring season was rained out, so everything just got rescheduled. Just carbon copy doing the thing here in September coming up. That's going to be a lot of fun. 6:30 to 9 p.m. Special offer, two tickets and a bottle of wine. It's a selection of two different ones for $25. Go check out PontchartrainVineyards.com for that. A couple things also going on, friends, this weekend in town that I want to highlight. One is Hispanic Heritage Celebration, which is going to be really cool. That's going on Saturday and Sunday at Annunciation Park, which is at 1500 Annunciation Street. There's going to be all kinds of celebrations of broader Hispanic culture, so it's not limited to, you know, Mexico, which I'm going to talk about why I say that in just a second. But there's going to be music. There's going to be, I think, a soccer demonstration and some food. All of this stuff, I highly recommend checking out the NOLA.com calendar. They're really good about listing more details on that, which I'm not going to get into here because we're going to be a little short on time, but also did want to mention the Mexican and Central American Independence Day celebration, which takes place tomorrow, if you're listening to the radio show. So Friday, September 15th from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. That's at Casa Borrega, which is the restaurant there. It's at 719 Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. There's going to be a street party to celebrate the Mexican and Central American Independence Day. It's a shared Independence Day, celebrating independence, of course, from Spain. And it's free and open to the public, which is going to be very cool. Regional food and drink, as I said, street party, and music by the fantastic, if you haven't seen him, he's a New Orleans resident, of course, but he's originally from Honduras. Freddy Omar con su banda, which means Freddy Omar with his band. They do really great Latin music, super lively, lots of good fun. So friends, hey, come on back. We're going to take a break here on the show. We're going to come back, chat with Jim Clark from Wines of South Africa for a little bit. Then we're going to chat with Sal and Matt about beer at Old Rail Brewing Company. Interesting, interesting show. Really appreciate you tuning in today. We'll take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show. And friends, come on back.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass Wine you drink.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
Get in the groove and let the good times roll. We're gonna stay here till it's to our soul.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Noel Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Hey, thanks for tuning into the show today. As you know, if you're listening at the top of the show, we are now chatting with my friend Jim Clark, who is the U.S. Marketing Manager for Wines of South Africa, henceforth known as WOSA in this conversation. Jim, how are you, man?
Good, how are you doing?
Great. It's excellent to see you. I get to see you about once a year, but although it's been a little bit more frequent now that you're here in town.
Yeah, I try to get down here as much as I can, but it's just me for the whole U.S. as far as WOSA goes, so I spread myself pretty thin, unfortunately.
Yeah, there you go. And I'm glad, and I know you're going to say that New Orleans is one of your favorite places to visit, right?
Absolutely. I actually did my bachelor party here just a few months ago.
Oh, okay. I did not know. I knew, congratulations, we were talking about this before.
Thank you.
That you are recently married, but I didn't know you did your bachelor party here.
Yep. I came down and ate and drank our way through the French Quarter Festival.
So, oh, yeah. That's what a great time to come down.
Absolutely.
That's some good, that is a quality bachelor party, Jim.
I was very happy.
Do you have anyone else in your wedding party yet to be married that's going to have to try and top that bachelor party?
Actually, there's a couple. I don't know if they plan to ever do that, but now they've got a high standard set, I think.
Very high standard set. Absolutely. Very cool, man. And again, congratulations on your recent nuptials.
Thanks so much.
Absolutely. So, Jim, you are, as we mentioned, let's talk a little bit about what WOSA, or Wines of South Africa, is. You're representing the wines from the country here in the United States.
That's right. I'm not with a particular importer or set of brands. If it's South African and it's here in the U.S., I want to give it a helping hand. I'm not a salesperson. I'm more of an educator. The idea is to kind of soften the ground so then the people who are selling the wines can match them with the right people and bring these wines to the people who want to drink them.
So. Well, and let me ask you this, Jim, since I know a little bit of this from your background, but how did you get to where you are? How did you end up working with WOSA? I know you have a long background with wine.
Well, I actually have a degree in music, and when you come to New York City with a degree in music, you work in restaurants. And I was very lucky to work at a restaurant group that had a master sommelier running the wine program, Greg Harrington. He actually makes wine in Washington now. And he was a great trainer, and I got interested in wine. And very early on, I won a writing contest with Spanish wines, but the fellow who organized it also worked with Wines of South Africa as a consultant. before they ever had a full-time office. So he started educating me about South African wines and using me as a resource to do presentations and things. And about, well, just over 4 years ago, when I was looking to get out of the restaurant side, they were looking to take someone on, and here I am.
That's a that's cool. And was that an interesting challenge to you then to kind of move into that sales realm, or not, education realm and representation realm?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it reflected some of the stuff that I most enjoyed when I was a sommelier, like training staff and things like that. And I had taught music, and I had actually taught English in Germany for a couple years. But the big thing was actually learning more about what happens behind the scenes, what the needs of retailers really are. Obviously, I knew the restaurant side, but not the off-premise. And I also find that I spend just as much time talking to South Africans about explaining, teaching them about the American market as I do teaching Americans about South African wine.
That's a really interesting point, right? And that is a lot of the role of WOSA, is to represent South African wines in these other environments. And as you said, soften the ground. But navigating, and Louisiana is no exception to this, or anywhere that anybody's listening to the show, the nuances or machinations, I'll even use that word, of how a market works, it's tricky. So if you're making wine in a country or in a region, it's not one size fits all in how you get those wines out there, is it?
Not at all. And if you, well, for example, the UK is a traditional big market for South Africa, and you can, if a retailer asks you, you can send him wine, you know, from South Africa. Here's a pallet you can sell in your shop. Whereas here, as we know, it has to go through the importer and then probably through a distributor, and then it goes to the retailer. We have the three-tier system in most states. And that always comes as a shock to a lot of South African producers when they first start negotiating the American market.
Yeah, they're saying, I have to pay this person to do what?
Exactly.
Now, Jim, had you been to South Africa prior when you got involved with WOSA initially?
Yes, I had been as a guest of WOSA a couple times because I was a writer and because I was a sommelier, starting in 2006. And it's obviously become more frequent. I think I'm coming up, Friday I leave for South Africa, and that will be my 18th visit.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And how long, when did you start with?
I started with them 4 years ago.
4 years ago.
Yeah.
So four times a year-ish, if my math's
With them, it's basically been twice a year since I started, but okay. Then there were visits beforehand. And we took my father for his 70th birthday. My whole family went down as a non-wine trip as well. So
it involved wine, though, I'm sure, right?
Oh, definitely.
Okay, just want to make sure. So that it's a really interesting place. And one of the things that we're talking about here today, Jim, as you know, we'll get to more of the specifics, but for the first time ever, WOSA is putting on a South Africa Wine Week that kicks off at the end of October.
That's right.
And it's going to be a whole, and then a lot of this is taking shape as we speak, but it's going to be a whole week's worth of events, tastings, bottle shops where you can go get taste wines at their weekly tastings, stuff on sale, get exposed to South African wines. And where I want to go with this, we'll circle back on the specifics on the event in a little bit, but it's a fascinating wine story in South Africa, and I think one that can really resonate here and have appeal here in New Orleans in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think, well, we actually chose New Orleans as the place we wanted to do this because I feel like there is kind of a cultural affinity between the two, and that both are such a mix of different cultures. South Africa is kind of unique. It's who would have thought that a great wine country would be discovered by the Dutch?
right.
But then you have the English coming in, you have the Portuguese, you obviously have a number of different African tribes. There were Asians who were actually brought as slaves by the Dutch and English. So there's a lot of parallels between what happened, here in America, but especially here in New Orleans, where you had the French and the Spanish and the English and so on and so forth, you know, and the native tribes and so on.
Yeah, that's a great point. So you and I were talking about before we went on the air here that there's not necessarily a huge amount of direct cultural connection, but there's a significant amount of historical parallel, as you were just saying.
Exactly. It's more a case of two things happening very similarly in parallel, but not necessarily where they were connected together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And so the multicultural component and the contributions to the wine industry then specifically with all of these different cultures, it's not just you had the, in some cases, right, where it's you have a particular cultural group come and bring. It's not the Romans bringing winemaking to South Africa only, and then that's it, right?
Right.
It's a wide variation. Some of the indigenous folks, African folks, have a huge role to play in the wine industry there, do they not?
They do, and obviously, under the apartheid era, they had mainly a role as workers, as labor, but that's right. Becoming much more sophisticated. We've got some wonderful black winemakers. Nentsiki Biela is the first Zulu woman winemaker, and she's become a real great face for the for the industry and makes wonderful wines too. And it's fascinating because it's actually not part of their culture to drink wine. So when she took her first scholarship as a wine student, she had never really tasted wine.
That's really interesting.
Yeah,
and is that changing in some of the local culture too, where it's becoming. So not just some of the traditional environments in which wine is drunk, but in some of the, meaning from the wine perspective, in more of the broader culture, is wine in South Africa starting to become more popular?
Definitely. It's reaching out beyond the kind of Western Cape, the area around Cape Town where all the vineyards are. Now, South Africans from all across the country are very proud to drink it. And as you see the what they call the rising black middle class, it's a kind of an aspirational beverage. You make it by getting a nice bottle of wine.
Right. Yeah. Okay. No. That makes a lot of sense, and we got about a minute here, Jim, before we're going to take a break. It's a really fascinating story, and this is something that we're going to be telling on the show here in the coming weeks, so we won't go too far down the road of a history lesson. But in a lot of ways, wine has been made there for centuries now.
Yep, since first vintage was 1659.
Right, so yep. Really long, and people might go, wow. I would never have thought that wine was made since the 17th century in South Africa. It's got a long-standing tradition, but what are some of the more modern era, the story, we'll talk about this after the break, the modern conception of winemaking is in some ways because of apartheid and the bans lifted on South Africa for economic exchange and these sorts of things has really changed just in the past couple decades or 25 years or so.
Really, since the end of apartheid, the first democratic elections were in 1994, and there's really been kind of three waves of different change, I would say, happening since then that have really brought South African wines forward since then.
Let's do this, Jim. That's perfect. You set it up great. So we're going to take a little break here on the show. We're going to come back, talk a little bit more about what Jim was just teeing up there for us, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the wonderful wines that you can get from South Africa, some of the great value that these wines represent, and then, of course, we're going to tell you, we're going to just put it in the back of your brain for the end of October, South Africa Wine Week coming up here in New Orleans. Friends, come on back.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
The French Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m. On Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with New Orleans' own Sazerac Company, makers of Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In case you haven't noticed, rye whiskey is hot, flying off store shelves and dominating the bar scene in New Orleans and around the country. Rye's spicy and assertive character is drawing in those looking for whiskey with a bite, but that equally pairs well with cocktails. Enjoy it in cocktails like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, or simply savor it on the rocks. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Give me a great big glass of wine. Give me a great big glass of wine.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Noah Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Yeah, we're chatting with Jim Clark from Wines of South Africa, or WOSA. And Jim was just mentioning, you were mentioning, Jim, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the three identifiable waves, or periods of history in winemaking that we can look to post-apartheid.
Yeah, the way I see it, and this is not official WOSA policy, it's just kind of my own personal view, is, well, the American embargo against South Africa ended in 91. And in 1992 at Cape Classics, our kind of first specialty importer, and there's some growing interest, and they were bringing over some great wines. And there were other wines that were coming over that, well, for lack of a better word, weren't so great. And the problem was that we kind of had a cellar palate, as they say. If you think of it, an individual winery, if a winemaker's only tasting his own wines all the time, you know, the wine can kind of go off the rails, but it's kind of happening vintage by vintage, and he gets used to it, or she, and says, well, I don't see what's wrong with these wines, because they're not tasting them in the context of these other wines. So South Africa had that, but they weren't tasting the wines of the rest of the world because of the embargoes and under apartheid. So suddenly they've got these wines that have kind of gone off the rails stylistically and need to be brought back in. So that takes a while. You can change your winemaking very quickly, but when you have to make changes in the vineyards, that takes a lot of time. So maybe around 2000, I think you see a big jump in quality. But there's a kind of a crisis in confidence. A lot of the wines made in that period often imitate international styles. So if it's a South African Chardonnay, it's trying to taste like a California Chardonnay of that period, which, you know, that big oaky sort of approach.
Right.
Or if it's a Shiraz, it tries to taste like a jammy Australian Shiraz. And then around 2007, 2008, you have a new generation of winemakers, or even some of the older guys, the established guys, relearning what they're doing and getting a new confidence in what they can produce that's genuinely South African.
We were talking about this during, this is a great point, Jim, and we see a lot of, during the break, you and I were chatting about this. It's almost a common story in a lot of wine regions in recent years. We were talking about Texas a little bit. You even saw it happen in parts of California. Very common where people start out, as I like to say, planting what they think they should plant versus what they're supposed to plant. Or
yep.
You can even flip that around. But finding what grows well, what performs well, the interesting spin on South Africa is that because the wine industry was so isolated that you had every, you know, it was self-contained. So everybody was trying to match or maybe do these different styles right in the country and appeal to a broad South African market, as opposed to saying, I've got this particular varietal, it does great in my terroir, this is what I need to do.
Yeah, I think there's that. And I think then there's, even when they turned to the international market, they still kept this chase the market approach.
This mimicry kind of thing.
And either a mimicry, or even look at the story of Pinotage, which is this great grape. It was developed as a cross in South Africa, so it's indigenous to them. And they said, well, we've got something no one else has. Well, let's put that forward. Well, when everyone does that and it gets planted in all these areas where it doesn't do well,
right.
Then
yep.
You end up getting inferior versions. And it is a challenging grape. It's the child of Pinot Noir and Cinsault. And Pinot Noir in particular, we already know, is a very finicky grape. And Pinotage inherited that. And then you put that forward as what's supposed to be the face of the industry, and it's a challenge. not just because it's unfamiliar, but because it's a difficult grape to make a great wine from. You can do it, and when you have a Pinotage now, it's someone who's devoted to the variety, not because they think it's a good marketing choice, it's because they believe it's the best suited to what they have for
and
their
where,
vineyards.
And exactly, right, and where they are, and that was exactly what we're talking about. What my point is that you Pinotage, it's finicky, as you said, and it's got to grow in almost analogous to growing conditions of Pinot Noir. It's a thin skin grape, right? Doesn't like too much heat, correct? A little bit more than Pinot Noir does.
Yeah, it actually has a thicker skin, but the problem it has is that it tends to lose its acidity very quickly as it's ripening, and that leads to a lot of problems because you need acidity during fermentation, or you get a lot of other, not just yeast, but other bugs during the fermentation, creating off aromas. So that and managing extraction at the beginning of the fermentation are the two big challenges for it.
Okay, got it. So the industry has then moved on to develop of finding, again, what we're talking about here, what does perform well, where the particular vineyard and winery are, as opposed to trying to grow something you can't. And what we're seeing, so you mentioned Pinotage, another excellent grape that's coming from various regions in South Africa is, of course, Chenin Blanc.
Yeah, Chenin Blanc has a long history. It's believed to be one of the first three varieties that was brought to South Africa in 1655. And it took off as far as plantings go in the 20th century because it's a good wine to make if you want to make a lot of grapes per hectare. You get really, really high yields. And so it's very productive. But if you want quality, you need to bring those yields down and then you get focus. And that's what's happened in the past few years. South Africa is the largest producer of Chenin Blanc. It has more Chenin Blanc planted than the rest of the world combined. And that's especially significant when you consider that the Loire Valley, which is second place, 60% of their grapes, of their Chenin grapes, go to making sparkling wine.
Right. So these are, and I've tasted now largely through you sometimes when you're in town, wonderful, wonderful expressions of Chenin Blanc. And the neat thing is because it does perform well across many regions in South Africa, that the diversity of both style and terroir, it reminds me in this regard of Sauvignon Blanc, is that Chenin Blanc is highly reflective of its terroir.
Definitely. It's a challenging grape to have as your most planted variety, as it is in South Africa, or as your signature variety, because If you taste one $15 example, you might like it very much. And then you taste another, and it might be a very different style. Even in the Loire Valley, which is quite a more consistent terroir in the sense that it's all cool climate, it can vary very much. So without that kind of reliability for the consumer, there is a Chenin Blanc for any person who likes white wine. Right. It's just a matter of finding the right region or producers within South Africa that makes it.
That's a really good point. And a lot of ones that we've tasted when you do your presentation here, you do see some that are more acidic that might hearken to a Sauvignon Blanc, some that are a little bit more floral in a sense that way, like lavender notes, these sorts of things. It can actually, I think it's a great grape to turn people on. If you're a Chardonnay drinker, we can find something for you in the Chenin world. If you're a Sauv Blanc drinker, we can find something for you in the Chenin world. And I think one of the neat things here too is it's a very food-friendly wine. And it's very, you know, we're talking about New Orleans, obviously, where we are. It's a very food-friendly wine with a lot of our cuisine here.
Absolutely. I think it has, when it has this freshness, which is great with seafood, that kind of, the acidity and kind of pop to it, but it still has some roundness and some body. So it's kind of good for when you have a little bit of spice, but you have a rich dish. It's going to stand up to the rich dish. It's going to kind of put out the flames a little bit between bites. Works really well.
It's great, and you find some expressions, I think, that have that range from sometimes tropical notes, but a lot of like white stone fruit and things like that.
Absolutely.
Can be very
yep.
common. So I think of sometimes certain goldfish that we might do with a fruit chutney or something along those lines can be very complimentary that way with the Chenin.
And that's a great comparison you mentioned with the chutneys and things. Very common in South African cooking. A lot of that Far Asian kind of curry spices came into South Africa. But they often kind of temper it with some dried fruits and things like that, like in a chutney. So works very well with their cuisine, works very well with the cuisine here.
That's great. And there's a lot of really interesting ones out there. And the neat thing, too, friends, is that we're starting to see here in New Orleans as well as beyond, we're seeing more and more South African wines in the market, aren't we, Jim?
Yep, it's growing. There's we've got our classic importers are bringing on more brands, and then we have some new up-and-coming importers who are embracing the category. It's nice to see even old, really established importers who have never touched South Africa are suddenly reaching out and saying, hey, we need to have South Africa in our portfolio. And then overall, we see just in the first half of this year, our numbers are up 13%.
That's great. And this is a message that we'll talk about in future shows. There's a lot of great values, too. We're not going to have to break the bank to get some really nice wines from that country. We haven't even talked about the red wines, which we'll do next time. But let's do this, Jim, because we got about a minute left. Want to plant that seed of South Africa Wine Week going on at the starting the end of October. Let's tell people about that here briefly.
Okay, well, what we're looking to do is just have restaurants and shops around town just kind of put South Africa forward. It tends to be, historically, it's always been in that lower corner shelf. Let's put it up in front and see what people make of it. Maybe offer some by the glass offerings for shops, just maybe some sales or tastings and things like that, because it's not a miscellaneous category. South Africa is, depending on how you count, the seventh or eighth largest producer in the world, and it's one that America has kind of overlooked for a long time, and that's starting to change, and I think this is going to be a great opportunity to look into it and see what it's got to offer.
And what are the dates, Jim? It's October
30th through November 5th.
Right, and yep. We're going to have all kinds of stuff. Stay with us here on NOLA Drinks, friends, because we're going to have all kinds of stuff coming out about that. And I also want to mention, too, that we did touch on this, that there's a lot of, you can pick up a beautiful bottle of South African wine for $15 to $30. It doesn't need to break the bank.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's an underpriced category.
Very much, and take advantage of that, friends. Really quickly, Jim, what's the website for WOSA?
It's WOSA.US.
Perfect. Jim, thanks so much for being here, man.
Glad to.
Yeah, we'll see you real soon.
Yep, definitely.
All right, friends.
Thanks.
Hey, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're going to be back, and we're going to talk about beer. Come on back.
Girl, it may be true. Honey, I may be the fool. Over here smiling and winking and making lies at you.
Hey ladies, are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Hey, thanks for tuning into the show. As you know, if you were listening at the beginning of the show when I told you what was going on, even though I never know what the hell's going on, we're actually here at Old Rail Brewing Company now at this point, and we're talking about beer. And as we kind of established last time, I had these two guys on the show the previous time. This is now our beer department. So we have Sal Mortilaro, certified beer judge. Sal, welcome back to the show, buddy.
Glad to be back again.
Absolutely. And then also my friend Matt Horney as well, who is the brewmaster here at Old Rail Brewing Company. Matt, Welcome again.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
Absolutely. And it's really good to have you guys on. And as we talked about last time, I said to you, Sal, that, you know, kind of you, the beer correspondent, certified beer judge. I'm going to throw Matt into this as the brewmaster. Unpaid positions, guys, talking about beer here on the show.
yeah. But at least, you know, we're getting to have a beer, so.
That's right. We get some good beer out of it, so that'll work for me.
Yeah, I love it, you know. And actually, Matt's providing the beer, so I'm, like, coming away great on this. But it's really fun to be here with you guys again. And here we are, just to be clear, we'll talk about this more a little bit. We're here at Old Rail Brewing Company, which is a brew pub in Old Mandeville, right here by the Trace, a cool spot. And Matt runs the brew program here. And Matt, you do a hell of a job with the beers here, man. As always, and what we're going to talk about today, we're going to talk about what we got going on. We're going to talk about the idea of seasonal beers, both specific to what we're talking about this time of year, end of summer, coming into fall, and then conceptually seasonal beers from a perspective of taste as well as from a perspective of agriculture and production realities. And then we're going to drink beer and talk about that too.
Sounds good.
Cool. And I think we're going to talk about water and some of these things and some stuff like that. But like you guys, so one of the things that I want to get into now that we are, last time we talked was more, you know, kind of towards the beginning of summer. So we tasted the really good Saison that you made, Matt, and you were on the cusp of actually putting out your light American style lager, which I've tasted subsequently and was excellent. Now, guys, we move into the fall. So we kind of shift into those fall beers. And like anything, you know, a beer, the turnaround time is maybe a little quicker than it is, obviously quite a bit quicker than something you say like wine or even some spirits, but it takes some time. So that forethought, let's just start here, Matt. Where are you now? Like, what were you doing today here in the middle of September to get ready for fall beers coming out?
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind comments. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, man.
Well, today we're getting ready to make the room for the fall seasonals that are going to be coming. We moved some beer out of the serving tanks just to get some tank space. Moving the Helles out of the way for a fresh batch of Helles coming in. Moving the light lager for the Oktoberfest. And then kind of a non-seasonal thing that's going to be occurring. But we're going to move our double IPA out of the tank, and then we're going to put in a Czech Pilsner. So a lot of lagers coming, not necessarily seasonal, but kind of a neat thing that's going to happen.
Is that going to happen? Okay, and cool. Now, when one of the things that I'm going to get this out of the way now, and I was joking with you guys before we went on the air, we are right about now where we are in mid-September. As I said to you guys, the gourd that shall be named Pumpkin is on its way in the world of beer, coffee, cake, almost everything, ice cream that you can possibly imagine. It's on its way, Sal, isn't it, as far as in the beer world as well?
It is. love it or hate it, there's definitely a very divisive, great divide amongst beer drinkers. You either love pumpkin beers or you hate pumpkin beers. As we move more into the Thanksgiving season and the holidays, the Christmas season, we're going to see a lot more of these spice-style beers, beers that are reminiscent of pumpkin pie, gingerbread, treacle pudding, cookies, things along those lines, spruce-style beers, Christmas-style beers. We're going to see those coming out from several breweries, both locally and nationally.
Right. And I want to make sure that we're clear, because I actually am a pumpkin beer partisan, although the manifestation and the sheer amount of them is just almost overwhelming now. So we don't want to couch all of these things in the idea that, you know, fall beers are meant to be summarized by pumpkin beers. Matt, are you doing a pumpkin beer, man? Or no, you're doing something a little different, actually.
Yeah, we do have a pumpkin beer per se. We've done it. I think it's been, I don't know if we did it the first year we opened, but definitely 2014, 15, and 16 we did it. It's called Pumpkin Express, and last year we actually were able to source some squash that we use, which is one of the. It's rumored to be one of the better squashes that you're going to use if you're going to make a pumpkin pie. It's got a creamy texture. It's a little sweet. It's called Red Curie Squash. And so we chose that one, and we went with it. And actually, the final result was really nice, and it had a great character. We roasted it in-house here and pureed it ourselves and used that in our mash. And it's a really nice product to use. And instead, the pumpkins are all different because you're going to get different sugar contents.
So, right, okay.
And different flavors, too.
You know, this is kind of a nice springboard, so we'll kind of put the pumpkin stuff in the past unless it comes up contextually now. Is that we're talking to you guys, and what I want to talk a little bit about here is that we have this sort of concept, you know, seasonal beers, and everybody has heard that term. So you think, okay, lighter beers in the summer because it's summer and it's hot and I want something lighter. Heavier beers in the winter because it's colder and that sounds like it tastes better to me. But there's sort of, you know, some of these cases, there's historical tradition, there's agricultural components to this. We talk about production methods, storage method of grains, all these different things that might relate. So even something, say, like using squash, which of course pumpkin is, as you said, you know, this makes sense. Squash, you want to use it fresh, right?
Right.
And this is when squash is available. Mm-hmm. So the idea is, and you guys just sort of jump in here, it's a very open-ended question. As we move into the fall here with seasonality, there's taste and then there's reality of what's available to you. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I know, Sal, you have some thoughts on that.
Yes. So, you know, I've done a little bit of research on this, and some of the things that I've read that I've seen is that some of these pumpkin beers actually go back to colonial times when America was first colonized from England. It's one of the vegetables that they had to use to make fermented beverages. So they did definitely use what was available to them. As that evolved, you have these holiday beers, these pumpkin beers, Thanksgiving-style beers that are meant to basically be shared with friends around the holidays. You're going to find that they're going to be a little bit stronger in alcohol, which of course always leads to good cheer and merriment. And of course, your holiday meals are generally going to use these various spices, nutmeg, clove, cinnamon. These types of beers are going to complement whatever food you're eating. Your English, I'm sorry, your American-style beers and your Belgian-style beers are actually going to be the only holiday years that beers that use actual spices. Some German beers, English holiday beers, are just going to be pure malt, pure yeast. Is where they derive their seasonality from, if you will.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And you were talking, Matt, too, about this when we talk about sort of the agricultural reality of this. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about different, you know, so malts, wheat, some of these things, they can be dried, they can be stored, especially in modern conversation, as long as your temperature's right, you can do that. But the sort of wild card in all this is hops.
Mm-hmm.
And we're right now, this is when hops are generally being harvested,
right.
at least in our part, or mm-hmm. northern hemisphere, right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah, hop harvest just took place about 2 weeks ago, roughly, give or take.
Let me ask you this real quick. Mm-hmm. How much by variety of hops does that harvest date vary? Is it like a wine? Like grapes can be, you know, like wine grapes can be 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 weeks in a given year. Is there a pretty big spread with varietals of hops, or is it pretty boom?
Yeah, you're going to get some of them. I think some of the higher end hops, some of the more specialty types of hops are going to be... You're probably not going to use those so much in a whole cone setting, or you know, a fresh hop kind of style.
Okay.
But you know, you'll see a lot of the main things like Cascade and Centennial, and some of those things are going to be readily available as fresh hops, and there's going to be some of the other ones too. But a lot of the, from what I have noticed, is like a lot of the more higher end, the more expensive hops are going to be pelletized, because those are going to be more preserved.
What does that mean, pelletized?
Pelletized, so hops come in two forms. They come in whole cone and they come in pellet form.
Okay.
Compressed pellet form keeps everything intact, so supposedly you have more of the resins in it. Nothing's going to escape, or it's going to be lost in theory.
So it'll last a little longer in shipping and that sort of thing. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Or? Once the hops, when they're whole cone, the lupulin that's in there, it's like a little resinous powder, and that stuff can shake off. It can be lost. So the whole cone hops, some of that can be in there, it can be locked inside, but from my experience with using whole cone hops, if you look in the bottom of your, you know, the bag or, you know, whatever, you know, you have, you're going to notice a lot of resiny powder down there, because it's from its movement and stuff like that. Usually everything comes vacuum sealed, so and purged with nitrogen to keep the oxygen out, things like that. But the hop compression just kind of keeps everything in there.
Let's do this, you guys. I'm going to take a quick break here real quick, and then we're going to come right back. We're going to hold that thought, Matt. Mm-hmm. Yep. We're going to take a little break here on the Gold Drink Show. Come on back.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
With the season's beautiful weather, it's a perfect time to take a drive across Lake Pontchartrain and visit New Orleans' only local vineyard and winery, Pontchartrain Vineyards. Our tasting room is open Wednesday through Sunday from noon till 4, or by appointment. come enjoy a flight of our wines in our classically styled French provincial tasting room, or pack a picnic lunch and enjoy a bottle of wine on our patio overlooking the vineyard. While you're there, ask about our wine club. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint. And it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers!
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Hey, thanks for tuning into the show. And we are here at Old Rail Brewing Company, as you know, and we're talking about beer. And right when we left off, we took a bit of a break here, and we were talking. And before we get back into what we were talking about with hops, Matt, because we've almost killed this one. You made a really cool Goza-style beer, the Gin and Tonic, or G&T Goza.
Yep.
Tell us about that a little bit, man, briefly.
Okay. So Gin and Tonic is one of my favorite summertime cocktails. And Sal knows we're both roommates. So when I travel and I come back to Mandeville, I'll bring gin back from wherever I go. And that's frequently Michigan. That's where my parents are. That's where I'm from. So I'll visit Detroit and bring back some gins. And so what I decided this summer is when the Goza came out. Last year we did a cucumber version. We did a melon version. And that this time we would do something a little bit different. So
Matt, do me a favor, real quick favor. Tell people what is a Goza, just so they know.
So Gozas are one of the oldest beer styles that we know of. That comes from Goslar, Germany. It's named after the Goza River. And basically it's a salty, sour beer. And usually, traditionally, it has coriander in it. This doesn't have coriander in it just because we were flavoring it, so we didn't want to have that interfering with the other flavors. But yeah, it's I think it goes back almost a couple thousand years.
Okay.
In date. So. Yeah.
Go ahead, Sal.
It is one of the only styles that was exempt from the German Reinheitsgebot.
The purity laws. Okay.
Yes,
and why, just because you're it doing, was adding other
even,
things.
Even back, yes, correct.
Coriander so, and so on.
Okay. Exactly, correct. Back when this decree was done, it was only three things that were allowed. If you read the original translation, water, malt, and hops. Yeast, the fourth element, was not added in the original translation because this was back when they didn't know what yeast was and what it did. But it was considered, even back at the original Reinheitsgebot, it was considered a historical style even several hundred years ago. It's a very old style, one of my favorite styles.
You crushed the first one, man.
Yeah,
and so you're doing.
That's right. I knocked it out. I knocked it out, and I'm on my second.
Nice. It's a beautiful beer. So, and what did you do with this one, then, Matt? I interrupted you there.
No. So this beer, I tried to recreate the quinine effect on it and give it that quinine bitter finish, and then also kind of give it the essence of a gin, but not really because we're not actually going to infuse this with gin. But that comes through in like the lime, and then that goes a flavor, the tartness in there. But that all mixing with like a quinine flavor, it just kind of worked really well for the style. I was really surprised at how it worked. It took a long time to dial these flavors in to try and achieve what we're actually looking for.
because quinine's pretty powerful.
It's you have to be really careful on how you do it.
Big flavor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lime's a really big flavor too, so you know, these were difficult things to work with, but after testing and asking employees, you know, how do you think of this? What's this taste like to you? And coming back, asking them again, was your palate changes? So one perception one day isn't the same perception the next day. So it took about 2 weeks to try and to get it to where we wanted it to be.
I really like it. I noticed when I first sipped on it, I got a lot of the citrus. I got a lot of the lime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I got the sour.
Yeah.
As I've gone through the pint, which I've also crushed it largely, Sal, not quite as well as you, but close, is that I'm getting more of the subtle, I'm getting more of the quinine note a little later, mm-hmm. and I'm getting a little bit more of the herbal consideration on it as I've gone through the beer.
Yeah.
This is a really good, I mean, just because of the acidity on it and all that, this reminds me of an acidic wine, and that this is going to be a good palate cleanser mm-hmm. type thing, so like a spicy food consideration.
Right.
This is going to kill it with like tacos or anything along those lines, or Asian food is going to just totally kill it with that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Beautiful, man. Awesome. Well, you guys, let's get back to the hops conversation. So we were talking about, you know, one of the things we want to educate people on here, I think, is maybe sometimes we know wine, maybe some of us anyway know wine can be, it's an agricultural product that we're dealing with, a lot of variation from year to year. It's kind of ingrained in the messaging. But maybe sometimes people think with beer, and maybe even with spirits, that it's a static situation, right? These things taste the same every year. And we're talking about hops being a good example of something, agricultural product, and some of the volatility. And you guys were, and I'll throw this to you, Sal, real quick. You guys were telling me about alpha acids and what that means in a beer, and hops being a good example to illustrate that.
Correct. Alpha acids is a term that's pretty much the simplistic, the dumbing down of it is, it's the bittering power of beer. It's the percentage of, by weight of the hop, the percentage of the bittering compounds per weight.
Can I ask you this question?
Sure.
So there's also, and I'm drawing a blank on the name, when people rate IPAs and hop beer with, is that a related unit, or is that a totally different?
It is. Okay. There's a mathematical formula that what you're thinking of is IBUs, or International Bittering Units.
Yes.
There's a mathematical formula which translates the percentage of alpha acids, the length of the boil of the beer in production,
okay.
which translates into IBUs.
Got it.
Correct.
Okay, go on. I'm sorry. I want to clarify that.
So what we were talking about during the break is, we were talking about the agricultural component of beer. And what a lot of people don't realize is that, or a lot of people forget, is that beer is very much an agricultural-based product. It's hard to keep consistent sometimes with beers because you are dealing with products which have crop yields, and certain things are very much like wine, affected by the weather, the length, the picking season, all of those things. There's a very particular brewery in Louisiana that's pretty well known that produces a lot of IPAs and hoppy beers. And it's just interesting to get on the various forums and Facebook groups and kind of see people kind of forget that. You know, this was a better batch, or I don't know why they can't be consistent, or this or that or the other. But what they seem to forget is that you're dealing with a very volatile product. I think especially in the case of hops, your year, your terroir, depending on the weather, those IBUs are going to change. A good example is, for example, the Czech Saaz hops grown in Czechoslovakia area. The IBUs on average are 4%. However, that can swing anywhere from low threes, even high twos, all the way up to 6%. So depending on the year, it may... There are ways to correct that, but we'll just keep it simple. Depending on the year, depending on the crop, it may or may not be as bitter as, say, for example, years past. You may not get the hop flavors as years past, things along those lines.
Okay, great. And Matt, you mentioned this. You were talking about a recent, contractually, because this is what we try and do, right? These are the specs that you want to get from somebody. And you mentioned that you were looking for a particular level of alpha acids, and you got something that was much lower.
Right.
And I want to make sure people are clear on this, too, because I asked this question during the break. The lower the number does not mean more acidic, like on the pH scale. It's a load weight, like we talked
Correct.
About. Think about maybe moles in chemistry, which I'm way underqualified to talk about. But, yeah, so you got something that was much less, then.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing, because you never really know what you're going to get.
kind of deal. So we contract some of our hops because we use them in such quantities that we want to make sure that we're going to be able to get them. And so when that crop is harvested, it's going to be made available a couple months later. We take delivery on it. And the first thing you do on all these hops is just check your alpha acids on everything just to see where you fall in relation to the last year, so we can make adjustments on these recipes. And the case we were talking about was with our Helles lager, the Hobo Helles. Our hop variety came in probably about a little over half as less alpha acids than we would normally have expected in that hop. And what that did was we had to add almost double the amount of hops in it, which then adds more vegetal matter, or like more organic matter into your batch of beer when you're boiling, which means that you want to eliminate collecting some of that stuff and sending it through your heat exchanger into your, you know, into your fermenter. But then, you know, you want to be careful that you don't end up extracting any other flavors out of those things. And in some cases, there's nothing you can really do because you're still trying to achieve those alpha acids. You can adjust time, and you can adjust. There are certain things you can do, and you're going
to
be okay.
Matt, do me a favor. Hold that thought, because yep. We're going to take a break here. I need to take a quick break, and we're going to come back right to this. Friends, we're taking a quick break here on the Nola Drink Show. Come on back.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Down yonder, down on the farm, down yonder, where I was born.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Old Drink Show. Hey, we're talking about beer here with Matt Horney, my buddy, who is the brewmaster here at Old Real Brewing Company, and my buddy Sal Mortimaro, who is a certified beer judge, and my neighbors here in Old Mandeville, where we are. Good to be chatting with you, neighbors and friends.
Absolutely.
And Matt, we wanted to jump right back in and talk a little bit about, so there's only so much you can do to compensate. So you get this, the, you know, and you're handed this sort of raw material that varies every time, mm-hmm. right? And then you want to make a consistent star, you want to achieve what you want to achieve, but you can only do so much to compensate. You got to play the hand that you're dealt.
Yeah. And there's, you know, in the brewing process, if you have a 90-minute boil and you add hops at 90 minutes in your boil, you're going to get a greater bitterness by the end of your boil. If you add them in 60, you're going to get a less of a bitterness. So you can make adjustments there. If you're trying to extract any flavor at, you know, beginning at 45 minutes and you're still trying to use those alpha acids to get you your bitterness and flavor, then you're kind of running into a little slippery slope, and that's where we run into with the Helles, because we try and grab flavor and bitterness, and we don't really want to add another bittering addition in there. So when alpha acids come in, then you have to start making decisions on what's going to affect your recipe, your consistency, and stuff like that. So
in that instance, just for an example then, Matt, where would you make a choice, and what choices do you have to maintain the style that you want to maintain?
In those cases, in my experience, what we've done is we'll increase our amount of hops.
Okay.
Yeah, if we have a lower alpha acid, we'll increase it,
and that will add the bitterness.
It'll add the bitterness.
Okay.
If you know, and we actually had made changes to some of the recipes along the line with the Helles, where we've nixed a 60-minute addition and we've gone to a 45-minute addition. And that just, you know, worked well for that crop year. And then the next crop year comes along, and then we'll go back to a 60-minute addition. And that's just kind of the nature of the beast of what happens. To try and nail it every single time. Most of the times, it's going to be imperceivable. But to me, since I taste it every day and I'm around it every day in every single batch, you'll notice every little nuance. But most of them are not even really technically noticeable. And it's all within the style guidelines. It's all falling within the realm of what we expect. And that's where we got to kind of tell ourselves, okay, expect a threshold. You know, this is what we're trying to fall in between. Because for me, I can be OCD, I can be a perfectionist, and if I don't hit it, you know, it'll get to me. But
it's like a musician, right? Where you go, man, I flubbed that note, and 99.9% of the people in the audience go, what?
Right.
I have no idea
exactly.
That you flubbed that note.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so on your take on this then, because I know this is what you do as a beer judge. What is your take on that? When you're looking at a beer and you're evaluating a beer, when you pick the Helles, right, which is, I think sometimes we know,
sure.
I think sometimes people maybe think that like these lighter styles of beer are easier to make. They're actually kind of harder to make because you can't mask things.
That's true, yes.
So when you're evaluating this, are you looking at it, as Matt said, on a sort of, I don't know, a range of factors, so, but variation within the range.
Yes, so you are. Within the, for example, the BJCP, the Beer Judge Certification Program guidelines, the World Beer Cup guidelines, it's not a hard concrete, hey, you must have a moderate amount of malt and you must have a low moderate hop flavor with a low bitterness. Just throwing it out there, not for the Helles, but just in general. I'm using this as an example. It's not concrete. Ah, you didn't hit it exactly 100%. You're wrong. There are certain ranges. It may go from a low moderate to a medium range, right? There is a graduation. There is a scale which defines certain beer styles. Some you can taste multiple. If we lined up, for example, several Helleses, you may find that this one's a little sweeter than this one. This one has a nicer honey flavor than this one. This one has a very nice spice, hoppy spiciness compared to this one. So there is a range which is allowable, yes.
And so when you do that and you go through that process, so ultimately what we're looking for is you're sort of working through the different components, but ideally what we're talking about with really anything here, food, drink of any sort, you're looking for for balance, right? And,
well,
and the overall finished product, how it shows.
Well, absolutely correct. There are, within this, there's still, it meets the guidelines of what a standard Helles is. You break down the components to its malt, to its hop flavor, hop bitterness, mouthfeel, aroma, appearance, and there are certain allowable things, but, you know, it can't really be a Helles if it's a dark brown, right? If it's a dark brown color.
Okay.
It's supposed to be a nice straw, light, golden, crystal clear. So, yeah, there still is an overall arcing type of what defines a Helles or any style of beer. There still is an overarching understanding of what defines the respective styles.
So you look through each of these components, say, in the case of a Helles, what defines a Helles?
Yes.
Right, within this range.
Correct.
And then you go, okay, cool, yeah, check, all within the range. And then you're going to kind of go, okay, and then I go finished product. Finished product is this, and this is really ultimately what I'm looking at, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah. And the same thing for you, Matt, when you're looking for the finished product and to say, man, I'm trying to make a Helles.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I get to play with.
Right.
And then here's the end game of my glass, and this is where I'm at.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's how it goes when you start your recipe formulation. You look at what you got. Understand the style first. You know, understand what makes it a Helles. And understand, as soon as you look at, you know, the color, the IBUs, you'll know right away, like, what you need to do. And then it comes down to the more intricate things, like water chemistry, your yeast and things like that. Once you have all those parameters kind of set, then you can start going to town, start going
to
away
to tweak, to adjust to, where you want
right.
to go,
mm-hmm.
given that varying palette of colors that you've been given because of the agriculture, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the variation of things, and say this is the end game, and here's where I want to be.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Well, so let's I'm going to ask you this question. One of the things I want to do after we take this break and come back for the next segment, guys, is talk about water.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking a little bit about that before we went on the air. But I've always been curious about this. I think people out there, what is wet hopping versus dry hopping?
Wet hopping. So wet hops, fresh hops, that's whole cone hops. Some people use their mash tuns. Some people use a third vessel. And so basically you're taking hops, you're putting them, and it takes a lot. When you use whole cone hops, you need to use, on a rough scale, just for the sake of this conversation, probably about double the amount of hops than you would pellet hops.
Okay. They're not compressed. They're kind of just, as you said,
it's a little flour cone.
And they're not dehydrated in any way or anything like that. They're still damp, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They're going to be fresh.
Yeah.
And so... So those will go into, say, a big, huge kettle, and then you're going to put your wort on top of that, and you're going to let them soak and steep, and then you're going to draw off your liquid off of it. Dry hopping is when you're taking hops and you're adding them post-fermentation or at the end of fermentation cycle, and those are going to be usually in pellet form. And there's various ways you can add those. You can add them through a pump. You can add them through a third or a secondary vessel. You can add them through the top of a tank, through a port on the top of the tank. So wet hops are fresh hops, and dry hopping is something that follows in post-fermentation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Got it. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. All right. So, Matt, do me a favor. We got about a minute before we take this break. We're tasting another one of your beers. This is killer, man.
Thank you.
Tell us about this one.
So what we're having right now is Panoramic Milkshake IPA, double IPA. Milkshake is kind of a trend now, and you're starting to see it here more in Louisiana. But what that incorporates is lactose or milk sugar. Milk sugar is unfermentable. We use it in our Cowcatcher Milk Stout. And it gives it a creaminess. It gives it a different velvety kind of texture. Honestly, this is something that I've thought about over the years and wanted to do. The milk sugar's always been looking at me on the shelf, and I wanted to always try it. And now that it's actually happened, and we know that people really enjoy it, we're kind of comfortable with actually trying this and give it in a go. But it's nice. It gives a nice creamy texture, velvety, smooth sweetness, but it's not an offensively sweet. It's not a cloying sweet.
Mm-mm.
It finishes relatively dry, and it gives, a platform for all the hop flavor, all those hop oils and stuff to be suspended in, a little denser body, and just kind of keeps those things in suspension a little easier.
It's really nice beer, and you guys are going to take a quick break here. I love the cantaloupe melon note that pops on it, which is awesome. We're going to come back. We'll talk about the beer in a second. We're going to come back and talk about water, friends. Yeah, you know it. Taking a little break here on the Dollar Drink Show. Come on back.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In 2008, the Louisiana legislature made the Sazerac cocktail the official cocktail of New Orleans, affirming what New Orleanians had known for over 150 years. You just can't beat a good Sazerac. The Sazerac cocktail is the quintessential New Orleans drink, perfect for celebrating the arrival of fall festivals, football season, or just being proud to be a New Orleanian. For the official recipe, visit www.sazerac.com.
The French Market offers daily entertainment and delicious food and drink options throughout our six-block district. Whether you crave raw oysters or fresh produce, authentic confections or healthy daiquiris, you can find it here. Sit at one of our cafes and hear live local music. Enjoy a muffuletta, po' boy, salad, or cheese plate in the farmer's market. Check out our pop-up farmer's markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays for even more fresh food options. History is being made fresh daily at the French Market. Visit frenchmarket.org for food, drink, retail, and event listings.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
With the season's beautiful weather, it's a perfect time to take a drive across Lake Pontchartrain and visit New Orleans' only local vineyard and winery, Pontchartrain Vineyards. Our tasting room is open Wednesday through Sunday from noon till 4, or by appointment. Come enjoy a flight of our wines in our classically styled French Provençal tasting room, or pack a picnic lunch and enjoy a bottle of wine on our patio overlooking the vineyard. While you're there, ask about our wine club. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Noah Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Hey, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans. Yep, we're at Old Rail Brewing Company here in Old Mandeville. And the beautiful part about this is, one, great beer, and two, spitting distance from my house, which is awesome. But we're not going to go down that road, other than I don't have to go far down my road to get home, which is fantastic after all these wonderful beers that my good buddy Matt Horney here makes. And we're chatting also with my other good buddy, Sal Mortellaro. And Sal, we were just talking, you guys, we want to talk about this. Water. And it might sound kind of trite, and yes, we see commercials about Rocky Mountain spring water and blah, 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 blah. And maybe it makes a lot of sense to you, friends, that, of course, water, beer, duh, it really matters in the whole thing. It's a lot more complex, Sal, than that. And what you just said to me right before we came back on the air is that types of water in given circumstances are driving the styles of beer in many ways more than people probably realize.
Absolutely. It's arguable to say that water is probably the most important aspect of beer brewing. If you think about it, beer is 98% water. Throughout history, certain major styles of the world have come to be because of the local water available to them. If you think about the stouts of Ireland, their high alkaline water actually balanced out the use of the darker roasted grains, the acidic grains. If you think about the water of the Czech region, where they make these nice, soft Bohemian pilsners, these softer waters are good for their flavor profile, their hop profile.
Sal, really quick, so people are curious, so we're talking about like using the Irish stouts as an example,
sure,
where we have the water being alkaline, which means more basic.
Yes.
And then contradicting or the balancing with the acidic grains.
Correct.
It's base versus acid.
Exactly, correct. If you think about the waters on Burton-on-Trent, they're a little more conductive to hoppier style beers, English pale ales, a thing along those lines. And this is beer history. This is things that have been going on for hundreds of years. Even today, like we talked about, some of the hot styles that you're seeing, water very much is a big player in the West Coast and the East Coast with these IPAs. You have your hoppier West Coast beers, which are a little more dank, a little more base bitterness.
Musty, more bitter. Absolutely.
Yes. Yep. So, you know, the Russian River, that's going to be higher in those hard minerals, which are going to accentuate the hop bitterness. New England IPAs, you're going to have a little bit softer water. The chloride to sulfite ratio is a little bit different, and that is going to
get more
accentuate
of those sort of fruity notes.
Exactly.
Right?
You're going to get more of that hop flavor versus hop bitterness,
okay,
softer mouthfeel. Water very much is a big player. I've noticed, without calling any brewery out. You can tell which breweries don't treat their water. Very few breweries start from zero, if you will, when it comes to water. It's a clean water. It's completely clean, devoid of minerals, things along those lines. You can kind of tell which breweries don't make for water adjustments, because when you drink their beers, all of the beers they offer, if you really pay attention, there is very much a base commonality that you can taste throughout their beers.
So now, this is, and I'll throw this to you, Matt. So this mm-hmm. is something that maybe what might, people might think is maybe one of two things. So what, Sal, I think you've laid down is we're not just talking about, hey, water. I'm just throwing in the amount of water right. I need. No, but we're also not talking about treating a water to a level where it's also just a neutral mm-hmm. product, meaning it has nothing other than liquid volume and H2O
right.
going on. Mm-hmm. We want character in the water.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, and that's one of the things. So what we do here in Mandeville, the water has a high carbonate, high alkalinity. So we run it through a deionization filter. So we take all of that down. We take it back to zero mineral or trace minerals, get rid of the carbonate, and then we build it.
Just to break, so deionization, that's mm-hmm. what that means, right?
Yeah, deionization.
So can you describe that process a little bit more?
So we use a mixed bed filter, and what that does is it runs it through two different medium that are in there. And it readjusts the water ions and basically leaves some of the ions behind. They get stuck in the filter through the two different medium that are in there. And then when it exits, those ions have been removed. The water now has, you know, no salt, has trace minerals of other things. So it basically, that ion content that's in there is gone. Or reduced.
So you've gone from, you've kept a certain desirability of minerals that you want to keep. You've gotten rid of the salt.
Yeah.
So some heavier minerals are basically taken out.
In most cases, pretty much everything is going to be gone.
Okay.
And so in our case, we run it through stainless piping. And we run through stainless piping because we can't run through copper because it's going to leach all of the mineral content from that's in the copper piping. It's going to draw that out to try and balance itself to rebuild this water structure. What we do is we look at the beer style that we're going to do, and we do this for every beer that we do. We try and the best that we can through the best research that we can is trying to understand what constitutes beer styles from around the world. And we do that with our ESB. We try and recreate our London water. We do that with our German beers. And there's only so much you can do because you don't know exactly what they're doing to their water. They could be boiling it. They could be boiling some of those minerals out and turning them into like a white powder, a residual leftover. Calcium drawing some of those things out.
And then getting rid of it?
Getting rid of it.
Okay, yeah, entirely.
So you don't really know exactly what they're doing, and they're not going to really share that, so to speak. I mean, some people will, but...
Gotcha, yeah.
But then when it comes down to certain effects that you want to have in your beer with some of the new IPAs that are out and things like that, then it's rebuilding your water in a non-conventional way. You're throwing water chemistry from a source out the window, and you're just using the power of what the minerals can do to your benefit. Each mineral has its own advantage. Calcium has, you know, it can acidify your mash. It can increase enzymatic activity. It can gelatinize the starches. And then you get in magnesium. Magnesium adds nourishment for yeast. So, but you're going to get that from the grain, so you don't necessarily have to add it. So there's sulfates. Sulfates add the bitterness perception. It increases that. It also dries the beer out. It adds a fuller flavor. When you get into some of your other things like chloride, you're going to get into... a fuller, more rounded flavor. Salt's going to also do, it's going to add more flavor, a bigger
is
volume.
This like, is this a mouthfeel consideration?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All that right. definitely adds to it. And salt does the same thing. It gives it a more robust, accentuated beer flavor.
That makes sense.
A lot of those things have to do with malt, not necessarily hops all the time, but, you know, whatever you're doing with malt in there. So each one of those things can be readjusted. If you don't want to follow any particular country's water profile or city water profile, you can dial it into basically anything that you want to accentuate or you want to, you know,
So you take it back down to a neutral palate, if you will, and then reconstruct it, as you said, to try and achieve. So, I mean, I think this is really fascinating because I think people maybe don't realize that when you're trying to achieve a style of beer, this is quintessential to the equation of doing that. Now, let me ask you this question, Matt, if you don't mind, is that, so in trying to recreate these styles and being true to the styles, going about that process, breaking the water down almost on it, then adding back in to do that, are you starting to look at, okay, here's what we have here in Mandeville with our water, and I'm going to use that as my palate and kind of go from there?
We could bypass our filter, and we could use the city water that we have here, which is very good water. It tastes great. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. If we wanted to brew an Imperial Stout or an American Stout or anything like that, this would be water that you'd want to use because you have that high carbonate content, you have that high alkalinity, and those dark chocolate kind of roasted grains are going to be acidic, so they're going to take that alkalinity down, they're going to balance it out, and then that's going to affect your mash pH, which is where you have your grain and the water and you have a big oatmeal, basically, is what you've achieved, and you're trying to draw the you're trying to convert your starches into sugar, so you need a good pH range to be able to do that. And if your pH is too high, you're not going to achieve the proper sugar content that you need for fermentation.
Right. Okay.
So the dark malts can bring that alkalinity down within a good viable range.
Okay, great.
So that's one thing we could do here if we wanted to use this water as it is. We could brew some probably, you know, really good dark beer with it.
Or in minor tweaking or something.
Minor tweaking, yeah.
Water. Okay,
yeah.
Great.
And to bring back, you were asking about style guidelines before.
Can I have you hold the thoughts out really quick? Because I do want to get to that. So this is where we are with time here. Guys, let's take a little break and then hold that thought. We're going to come back to style guidelines and some overlap of that, which I think is where we're going to go with that. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about fall seasonal beers and talk about how you can become a certified beer judge and how you can visit Old Rail Brewing Company, which you want to do both those things. Come on back.
I'm going to need to parachute when I get through walking these blues. When I get back to New Orleans.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour, every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickey Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickey Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickey Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickey Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
Goodbye, Joe. I gotta go, me old Mayo. I gotta go, pull a hero down the bio. My boss is the sweetest one, me old Mayo.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Old Drink Show. Brian Deese here with you. Hey, yeah, we are in Old Mandeville at Old Rail Brewing Company and chatting with my friends Matt and Sal here, and we're talking about beer. Sal, we're water and style. Let's talk about that. You had some good points to make there, man.
So we talked real quickly about how beer styles and how they are, the particular styles are supposed to sit in a certain category or certain range of various things. And then we segued into water chemistry. A good example of bringing it back around is a Czech Pilsner or a Bohemian Premium Lager. Kind of one of the hallmarks of the style, one of the things that define the style, is that it is a soft, rounded bitterness that's very easy drinking. That bitterness is there, but it's not harsh. It doesn't sit on the tongue. It just sits there nicely after the swallow. We talked about water styles and how they translate into beers and how the water styles of the world came to be and define the beers. And that's one of the perfect examples. Because it's that water style, you must use a very low mineral. You have to have a low sulfite to chloride, very, very soft water in order to make the style. If you just use regular, say, Abita tap water or Abita Springs water, tap water, whatever, you're not going to hit that style. So it's kind of a... It's kind of the ultimate way to bring it all around. Sometimes your water does make or break your beer based on style guidelines. So,
and that makes a lot of sense. Yep. So then, like Matt was talking about deconstructing the water to build a backup to achieve the style and what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And that, this is really good, guys, because I want to make sure that we made that point. We talked about agriculture here a little bit and the variability there. Lots more to talk about. Matt, you and I were talking about the next show we'll do this. We'll talk about hop farming, mm-hmm. and we'll get further into that because I think people are interested in that. We're talking about, like anything, we're talking about agriculture products and variability. And then, as you said, Sal, beer is 98% water. So it's not just, you know, pouring something out of a bucket that you happen to get out of your tap. There's a lot that actually has to go into understanding, achieving style, what you're working with, and all that kind of stuff. So really interesting stuff you guys hear on that front. We'll come back to the story. These guys are great talking about this stuff. Now, what these guys are also great about is providing beer. And Sal, you've provided us with a really terrific beer that you made, man. And it's a really particular style.
It is. I made and I brought a Sammy Klaus. I brewed this last year. This particular style, we kind of touched on holiday beer, so that's why I wanted to bring this particular one. This is brewed in Vienna. The commercial
version. And the name
is,
of the style is Sammy Klaus.
Sammy Klaus, yes, okay. Which translates into Saint Nick. And it's brewed in Vienna at the Schlossberg Brewery. It's only brewed once a year on December 6th, which is St. Nicholas Day.
Yep.
It's unique in that it's a very high alcohol lager. The commercial versions are at about 14%. This one that I brewed, I ended up hitting 15.8% alcohol on it.
Well done.
It's a very, very malty, very malty beer, very sweet beer. You're going to get a lot of malt character, a lot of these dried fruits, almost port-like to a certain extent. Yeah, you're going to get a little alcohol warmth on it.
Sal, real quick, really savory, like on the nose. I get like a soy sauce note now, which is awesome.
Yeah,
but go on, then, Matt. I want to get your thoughts on the beer, but.
So it's unique. Like I said, again, this is the reason I brought it is that it's a holiday beer in that they brew it on December 6th, and then it's because of the amount of grain that's used, the high alcohol it has to achieve, it sits for almost a year in fermentation as well as secondary fermentation, lagering, maturing the beer. And that's what we have here. I ended up taking a gold medal with it at this past year's Belgian Big Beer and Barley Wine Festival in Vail, Colorado. And I'm pretty happy with it. I'm looking actually forward to making this year's Sammy Klaus.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's excellent, and I love that savory note. Matt, what are you thinking about this, Matt?
I think right off the bat, this is a big... This is a big beer.
It's a big boy.
Yeah, it's a powerful one. But yeah, the soy sauce, I get a little cherry, a little leathery kind of thing going on
in
there.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, dried fruits, kind of like dried cherry.
Dried fruit, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's, man, the flavor on it is so savory, and you just want to sip it. Like you said, port-like, and I think that's a really good description on the flavor, but the aroma is fantastic.
And the sweetness, like you said there, Sal, is really terrific, man. And, you know, and I always feel bad, like, for listeners out there, and I'm going to apologize this because we're tasting this beer that Sal made, gold medal winner, and you're probably not going to taste it. I'm going to taste it. We're tasting it. So I feel bad. I don't want to be a jerk. But, yeah, it's really, really well done. Thank you, Sal, for sharing this.
Absolutely.
Absolutely phenomenal.
Very good.
Matt, do me a favor, because we got a few minutes here left before we close out the show. We were supposed to talk about seasonal beers, and we kind of did, given the agricultural component. Mm-hmm. But we are coming into the fall here. So what do you got coming up in the fall here, man?
So in the next week or two, we're going to try and transfer some of this stuff this week. We'll have the Oktoberfest coming up. And that's
It's always one of our popular beers, popular seasonal beers. And this year we kind of changed up some of the malt brands on it. So it's interesting to see how this beer comes out compared to last year. It's probably pretty similar, but just kind of a fun little thing to do. Tried different German malts and things of that nature. Then following that, we're currently sourcing, we were talking about this earlier, we're currently sourcing our squash for the pumpkin ale, and the pumpkin ale usually releases around Halloween. We're definitely late to the game, but we kind of like it that way. We like to come
Isn't that the way it should be, man? Yeah. I mean, for God's sakes, people are releasing pumpkin stuff in September.
Right.
You're killing me. It's like Christmas decoration in Walgreens on October 1st.
Right. And, yeah. And our temperature here, I mean, we get to this malty kind of kind of heavier, not really heavier, but the bigger malt-based beers, and October seems about our time. In Michigan, if you were up in the north, if you were in the northeast or something, that might be now. But for us, it's October. It's the end of October. It's November, December.
It's still hot in Louisiana.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So
even though this week has been nice, but yeah.
And this is you know, the daylight starts changing. It gets darker a little sooner, so it's nice to kind of settle in with a little darker beer, and that's a prime time for it. So
we're in that transition. That's pretty cool. Well, Matt, do me a favor. Tell people where they can find you here at Old Rail Brewing Company.
So, yeah, we are at 639 Girard Street in Old Mandeville, just across the street from the trailhead next to the fire department and the St. Tammany Trace, about 2 miles from the Causeway.
Yep.
So 2 miles east of the Causeway.
Easy breezy.
Yeah.
So, and if you're in downtown New Orleans, friends, it is about 50 minutes max, 45 minutes max from the CBD or the French Quarter to get here.
I'll throw this out there. On Fridays, we do have the NOLA Brew Bus that comes by. So if you don't want to drive over here,
you can
do that. They go from here to Abita, and they'll spend some time here and then go there, and then they head back across the lake. So
perfect.
Pretty easy way to do it.
Awesome. And mm-hmm. great program. And it is stuff, stuff is done on premise here, and then you can do growlers, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yep. So you can take some of this stuff home. And that's the only way you can get it. So you need to make a trip here to check it out. Either get a growler, come taste the stuff, and see Matt. Now, Sal, coming up, man, you are a certified beer judge with the BJCP, and you're going to be helping other people become certified beer judges pretty quick, man.
Correct. Yes. So what I'm going to start doing is that I'm going to start hosting exams in Louisiana. Louisiana has been a little bit of a barren wasteland when it comes to the beer judge certification program. I'm going to ensure that we start hosting at least one exam every 6 months in the New Orleans area. We're looking, our next exam is going to be January 2018, and then we're going to have one in July of 2018.
Do you know where you're doing it, man? Or are you doing
it? We should be doing it here, anticipated here. If not, it will
here
be
at Old Rail.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, awesome.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
If most people are in Facebook nowadays, if you go look for Louisiana BJCP or Louisiana Beer Judge Certification Program, you can find our page. You can go ahead and get all the requirements, how to be able to sit for an exam, and keep up to date that way. So there are opportunities coming up here.
Awesome. And we'll be sure, Sal, you give me that information. We'll share it on our Facebook page. I'll put it in the show notes, all that good stuff. So we'll make sure we get that information out that way. You're a great guy to learn from, so make sure you check that out and come learn and drink. I'm going to use that pun. Drink in the wisdom that is Matt Horney and Sal Mortilaro. Guys, thanks so much for doing this today. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. You're very welcome. Thank you.
My pleasure. Friends, thanks so much for tuning into the NOLA Drink Show. We got a great chance to talk about beer. Prior, we talked about wines of South Africa earlier in the week, although it was all on one show. Go figure. So lots of interesting stuff. And hope you tune in next week. Don't know what's going to happen next week. We'll figure it out. We'll talk about beer a little bit more later on with these guys as well. And everyone, have a great weekend. And until then, cheers, y'all.